The Chris Perillo Show is brought to you by Microsoft Windows Media. Download Windows Media Player 10 at Microsoft.com/Windows Media.
God, this camera is awesome.
What camera?
Oh, I got a Canon SD500. It's a little, you know, teeny digital cam. And it's a 7.1 megapixel, but I got it for the video capability.
Holy cow. Wait a minute, which one's this?
SD500.
Is this a new one?
Relatively, yeah.
See, is it powershot.com?
No, it's just Canon.
No, I mean, like, finding more information here.
Oh, go to DC Resource.
Okay, the SD500.
Yeah.
So what kind of movie capabilities does it have?
This is actually one of the cameras that there's not a limit on the amount of time that you can record for.
Really?
As long as you have a high-speed, secure digital card.
Yeah.
And it records the AVI files. And the reason that it's important to me is because what we're doing over at Audioblog with video uploads, the first format we supported was AVI.
Yeah.
So what's really cool about this is that now just everyday people with digital cameras that record the AVIs, which is most of the Canon line, can upload and then boom, publish to their blog.
Yeah, I ended up finding an open source tool the other day that converts the QuickTime format, the MP4 format, into AVI or the MJPEG, which is usually what comes off of these digital cameras. This looks exactly like something I'm looking for.
And you know what's nice about it? You don't have to carry a big-ass camera like a digital rebel around.
Totally, dude.
And I just did some... I was just cruising across the Bay Bridge when it was still sunny. You know, doing ego shots and all that, right? It's what I do. And the quality is stunning. It was pointed at my face.
It's Canon.
And the sunroof is open, and then you see the giant tower of the bridge looming past overhead, and every element of the picture. And now, of course, I'm going to publish this. It's like 320 by 240.
Wow.
That's what I was recording it as, but it's just amazing.
So it'll only record at 320 by 240. It won't go larger than that?
It will actually do 640 by 480 as well.
But is it limited on the 640 by 480 time?
I don't believe so, no.
Dang. This looks exactly like something I've been searching for, because, of course, I've got the... one of my first Nikon, the Coolpix. Mm-hmm. My first Nikon ever. It's a 8800, and it's pretty big. I mean, it's for like serious photos, but it's what, like 8 megapixels or something like that, which of course is megapixel overkill. But one of the reasons why I got it and switched from the Canon line is because it didn't seem like any Canon camera had unlimited movie taking abilities, and
actually you do run into other limitations where they have less than average. I spent a lot of time over on DC Resource looking at these cameras. Now I have access to Kodak and HP cameras. Kodak's and Nikon's write to QuickTime, HP's and Sony's I believe write to MPEG.
Yep.
And for some reason, well, my involvement with HP, I know everything about everything that HP makes. It's just kind of creepy being a Mac guy and all. And so, yeah, I mean, it was just one format I didn't have access to. And it does end up being convenient, you know, traveling a lot, not having to carry a ton of stuff, and kids, and work, and all that. It kind of made it. So, yeah, it retails in the store for about $4.99, but you can probably find it at a good
really?
Online.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, I'm getting it. That's so sad, but I need something that I can carry around with me.
And you'll love the charger.
Is it compact, or does it...
Yeah, you open the box, and you know, see, it's got a small battery, fine, yeah. And you get the little tiny charger, and you spend like half an hour looking for the cord until you flip over the charger and see that it's a plug.
Yeah.
So it's one of those, and that was smart. That was really smart.
How's it doing battery life so far?
So far, pretty good. I've kind of beat the crap out of it as far as filming, and my wife, Kristen, she was running out with it, and taking pictures of like escalators and all this random stuff. You know, she just got a Flickr account, so she's getting into the groove and everything. And yeah, I mean, I only charge it when I go, I'm going to be gone all day or something.
Wow.
Yeah, and it worked out pretty well.
Yeah, I'm looking at some of the specs here on the website, and I wish this had been released, you know, a few months ago.
Well, see, here's the thing. I was looking for a Canon S500, but that's at its end of life cycle, and I just wanted to go into a store and get it, but Best Buy, Fry's Comp, all these places, they didn't have it. They had display models. It was $100 less. I already have a dozen compact flash cards.
Yeah.
And the one thing from people that actually have these cameras, they say, well, you never really shoot more than 3 minutes at a time. You know, you shoot something short, quick, to the point, you upload it.
Yeah, the movies. Sure.
So now I'm going to use the Rebel for more stylized work. I do a lot of work in the eBay space, but also things like the splash page on aircrise.com. That's the Rebel, you know. That's for the big stuff. But the only benefit that you really get from the larger megapixel cameras, and I think 10 megapixels and 35 millimeter, I think that's the one-to-one point, is that you can go in and crop and get details. Because, you know, 3 megapixel cameras, those are going to give you great 4x6 prints. And I think a 6.3 megapixel camera natively will kick out like 16x20. So if you have a large format printer, you know, you're good
to go.
Yeah,
you're doing pretty
good. But if you want to go in and crop something, and having such a small discrete camera, especially doing something with video blogging, that's the other thing. You know, video bloggers are known for whipping out that camera and holding it at arm's length. Well, you look less like an ass.
Yeah.
Just something that's just in your hand. You could be stretching, you know.
And I can tell you, that's one of the things that I certainly appreciate about the Nikon that I've currently got, the 8800. One of the things that I appreciate is the fact that it's got a stabilization feature that's built into it. So if I'm taking a movie or even if I'm taking still shots, I don't have to worry about any kind of, usually, any kind of shake or stuttering. It compensates for it automatically. And I can tell you, for videos, it definitely translates well.
And mini tripods are good for that, too. You can pick up, like, $30 of cheap little tabletop tripod, which is good because you can wedge in certain areas in the car if you're into that kind of narrated by small driving thing.
Or even a monopod works to a certain degree for that.
Yeah. You know, one of my cars is a new Beetle, and it's got the flower vase. It's like, yeah, hey, just put one leg of the tripod in there. No flower camera.
So wait a minute. Does this only support SD then?
Unfortunately, yeah. So
yeah.
If you've already got an invested interest in another card format. But the good thing about it is that the SD is much more of an affordable price point. You know, you get into the XD cards, which you're going to find on the Fujis and the Olympus cameras, you're spending more dollar for memory.
Well, it's just the same way with Sony. That's one of the reasons why I kind of walked away from Sony, even after seeing the PSP up close.
Mm.
I was tempted. I mean, if you haven't seen one and held on to one, it's quite an experience.
Oh, I have, and it is beautiful, and I do know that I think the next generation, or the next release, the next build, if you will, hopefully they'll have the dead pixel problems solved, but also I think they're going to start dropping the price like $50.
Oh, as well they should.
Yeah.
And I think after seeing just one video game, it was like some kind of futuristic racing game. I can't remember. I think Nintendo is in trouble.
Well, you know, the PlayStation has always had a certain place in people's hearts. You know, I've heard it argued that the Xbox is a technically superior machine, but it doesn't matter because the PlayStation Portable... Or, I'm sorry, the PlayStation, the backwards compatibility, just the fact that it's the kind of thing that people who compete with the Apple iPod, well, great, it might be better, but it's not an iPod.
Yeah.
And so there's a cultural attachment to it, I think, which makes it just like, what, Sony's got a portable? Rock on. I mean...
Well, there's a certain thing to be said about branding.
Yeah, but then there's also some of the things that really make it tough for me as a parent who, you know, kids are going to be growing up, they're going to be playing video games. I still play video games. Nintendo has a lot more, you know, Nintendo and Sega has a lot bigger franchise when it comes to characters.
Oh, that's true.
The Marios and the Sonics and the stuff that they can play before they, you know, become teenagers and start blowing up, you know, cities and stuff.
Like with Missile Command.
Yeah, right. You know, and there's some titles that are available. Some titles are actually pretty impressive, and there was a couple of good, IGN had a good review of Piglet's Big Game. You know, now most of us adults would be like, yo, how cute, you know, Winnie the Pooh. But as the technical excellence of the game, a kid cannot, you know, especially when you're talking about a young kid, like a 3 or 4 year old, they can't ruin anything in the game. You can only go where the character is supposed to go, and everything else you just bounce off a wall, and so it's really good controlled gameplay. And then, of course, Disney Interactive does have a lot of resources and an extensive character brand to throw at a game, and it's a lot of fun.
You tried any the Lego games yet?
Not yet.
Oh, dude, you gotta try them. I took a look at the new Star Wars Lego game, the one that's, I think that's what it's called, like Star Wars Legos. It's the for the Game Boy.
Yeah.
And, it was, and then I downloaded the demo that they had for the Star Wars Lego website.
Right.
And didn't want to play. It was only from Episode 1. I'm kind of keeping my exposure to Episode 3 relatively limited. Yeah. I've definitely read a few spoilers, but I don't want to know too much.
Yeah.
But try it if you haven't already.
I'm looking forward to all those cool things that the kids will get into when they get older. You know, the Mindstorms and all the Lego robotics. One real quick thing that I'm thinking of with the Winnie the Pooh game. What's really cool about it is that you don't die. You know, they treat every... And the villains don't die. They just kind of, like, poof, you know, into little, like, clouds, or they go into bottles or stuff like that. So I think it handles cartoon violence. Well, it's non-violence, really, and that's kind of interesting. It's always weird. You know, it's what a great time, right? You know, growing up, it was like video games were for kids, and then, you know, now I've got my own collection. I got my Grand Theft Auto separate from, like, you know, all these games. And so it's kind of interesting to be in this dual role of game player and then parent game of game player.
So do you find yourself playing Piglet games every once in a while when no one's looking?
Well, that's a secret.
Oh, come on. I'm not recording this. I swear.
Yeah. What's a podcast? you sometimes have to, because there are a couple of puzzles in those games that are kind of tricky. And, you know, anybody who's got kids, yeah, the impatience level of solve this puzzle, Daddy, solve this puzzle, Mommy. And you're like, crap, how do you solve this puzzle? So you got to, like, do it after they go to bed, like, spend up time. And the Piglet game can be a little bit addicting.
Well, you know, you probably remember text-based games where,
uh-huh,
you know, you'd have to type, go east.
Oh, yeah.
Those games were difficult enough. I mean, when we were kids.
Do you ever remember a text-based game called Kyrandia?
Kyrandia?
It was on, there was a BBS system. I'm going back here. I'm trying to remember the major BBS was the BBS software that was very popular. We're talking early 90s, and they had a couple of games. Well, first of all, they had Trade Wars.
Oh, yeah.
Trade Wars, the text-based version, was great. You know, it was this intergalactic trading and whatnot, and that was just so... I spent so many hours of my life doing that. But Kyrandia was one of those, you walk around, pick up garnets, you know, throw crap in a well, and it was such this very rich game that by the time you got up to, like, level 12 or whatever the top level was, you could cast these psychologically damning spells on characters in other parts of the games while you're trying to defeat the Dragon Czar. And, I mean, just these... this is the best stuff ever. And then it was like, I'm talking about a text-based game, getting a little too excited about it. But, yeah, I loved it. My earliest exposure, actually, to Apple Macintosh, my mom brought one home. She worked at Quantum, the hard drive maker, back in 1984. 85, and she brought home, she was really big in doing documentation on a Wang system, and she had a Mac, like one of the Mac Classics or Mac Pluses or whatever, and she brought one of those home, and I remember it had one of those text-based games, you know, and I think there was like a TARDIS or a robot or something in there. It was just all this weird stuff. I don't even remember. Maybe a Star Trek, I'm not sure. But, yeah, a lot of fun with those.
You know, I had, just found a website called virtualapple.com, and it's tons of ROMs, or I guess you wouldn't consider them ROMs, like games are sitting there, mm-hmm, from the old, and I don't know if it's just the Apple II or Apple IIe, but sure enough they have Oregon Trail, which
nice.
Is the game I remember playing on the Apple IIe at the library and at school. It was the only computer I think we had in the entire city of Des Moines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I vaguely remember that.
Yeah, it's definitely evolved. You know, to a certain degree, I have to limit the amount of games that I start playing, just because I know I can get sucked in real easy.
Did you ever get sucked into The Sims?
No, I missed that whole ball.
Oof. That was fun. One of the things that we never actually implemented on the radio show, this is, of course, pre-podcast era, most of the guys that are on my show today were around, and we were doing shows back then. And we were getting all ready, and we had started to record basically our show, but in Sim language.
Oh,
so we'd
no.
be like, babaloo, babla, and we would actually construct a show so people could get the MP3s, and then they could install them into the video game.
God.
You know, and then you could actually have us on the jukebox or the radio or whatever. It was quite amusing. We never actually went through with it, but there was a huge economy. There are all these little micro-economies that surface, and one of them is, like, in the eBay economy, the Beanie Baby craze.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and that was actually quite profitable, because at the time we were living in Orlando, so we could actually go to Disney World and get Disney World exclusive Beanie Babies and then trade them online for all these, like, hard-to-get beanies from Hong Kong. But the same thing was with The Sims. I mean, people would make objects for the games, and that was just awesome to see how it worked. And, you know, I think Second Life or Third World or whatever, those, that's like the new, that's the new black. You know.
It's black. It's the new black.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have to limit my exposure to just puzzle games. So the last series of games I really got into, did you ever play Pandora's Box? And I suppose being on OS X, you probably didn't.
No.
It was a Microsoft game, and it was a series of puzzles that kind of took you on this world tour and got progressively more complicated, but it was the same type of puzzle. Mm-hmm. And it was challenging, but it was one of those things that I stayed up all night until I finished that darn game. And that's usually what happens. I get obsessed.
Oh yeah.
With games, and it's like sugar. It's very addictive. So I have to limit my time in front of those things. Otherwise, I get pulled in.
Oh yeah, it real easy. Wipeout, actually, you mentioned Wipeout earlier. Wipeout was a franchise that I just absolutely loved. That was actually where I discovered Red Bull, by the way. Was in Wipeout XL. And I just remember, you know, seeing all of these phony billboards in the game, right? And you know, Wipeout being the whole anti-gravity, you know, futuristic thing.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
And all of a sudden, I think I walked into a mobile gas station and saw Red Bull, like, oh my God, that's that thing that I saw in the game. I thought it was just a BS ad. And, you know, sure enough, it's like, well, this is pretty cool. And you could only actually find Red Bull at that time. This is probably around 97. In gas stations. It was like only mobile gas stations, and then it started just flooding the market, right, because it became the thing. But yeah, Wipeout was one of those games, because I could get the fastest times, the fastest laps, you know, some of the best maneuvers, gold medals, all levels, all you know, unlocking all the things. I just like owned it, that game. That was, and I was never really a big game player. In fact, I was actually much older, even though I had, I mean, a lot of my friends were playing games far before I got introduced to things like, you know, the gold Zelda cartridge.
Oh, man.
On the Nintendo,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that was just like, I love that game. I love that game so much. That was just like the hottest, coolest game. And it's like, you look at it now and you're like, oh, how cute.
Yeah. Well, it was quaint, but even so, I mean, those simple games, I still love playing them. I mean, I've got the Atari joystick that you can plug into this machine, and of course, I've got all the emulators,
right,
you know, on the computer, so if I want to play a round of Adventure, I can give it a go and not have to worry about it, you know, and get really sucked into it. And I think the further we go into these, you know, highly addictive games, the more we need those simple games. And I think it's probably why those Flash-based games that get uploaded to the web kind of go viral when they do, just because they're just simple, stupid, silly, mm-hmm. and you know, time wasters, and that's all they are. But no, I'm reminded of how I saw Sobe is a product placement in what was it, Oddworld, Munch's Odyssey, which was one of the first Xbox games.
Really?
To be released.
Well, I remember playing that prior to it getting sold to Microsoft.
Oh, okay, Oddworld.
Yeah, like Abe's Odyssey.
Yeah, this was Munch's Odyssey, which is like. I guess in another part of the series. It was the only one that I had played, and I got pulled into that game as well and couldn't stop playing it until I finished it, and which is horrible. I hate getting, and I've just got that kind of personality that if I get into something, I'll stick with it until I either, you know, get frustrated to the point that I don't want to do it anymore, or it's like I get sucked in. So I tend to go with like racing type of games. Like I did Pod Racer. I did, what was the, not Rebel Strike, that was on the GameCube, which I did play, but dropped it because it got way too complicated.
Right.
Or just not complicated, just difficult to master, you know, to get through. I mean, I just could not get past certain, you know, certain points, and it was just frustrating. But I loved playing, what was it, Rebel Alliance? No.
Rebel Assault?
No, Rogue Squadron.
Oh, yeah.
Rogue Squadron for the PC. It was, and I beat it. I mean, I got through everything, gold coins on all the way through. But it was just something that, it was fun, it was easy enough and challenging enough that I didn't, like, feel like the game was beating me. And that's where I really get lost with a lot of these newer games, is that you've got to master all these commands in order to command the game, and that's fine if you've got the time to get into it and the graphics are absolutely wonderful, but at the same time I have to decide, well, what do I really want to do with my time?
Right, yeah, I know.
Yeah, do I want to learn something new that has some amount of value and that I can, you know, take and apply to other things that I'm doing, or learn how to, you know, do a keyboard command with these five fingers across the keyboard?
Well, yeah, and for me, it's like a matter of time. The only chance I actually get to play video games is when I throw a party. And that might sound like a pretty odd thing to do, but when I throw parties, I make sure that, like, everybody has something to do. We'll get a DJ. We'll make sure that the Wi-Fi is flowing. We'll get a couple of game consoles on a couple of big screens. And we'll just set up, like, the whole place. Got the barbecue out back. So that you could actually sit in a corner and geek. You could set up an impromptu LAN party. You could play some games. You could listen to the DJ. That's how I just throw parties, right? And that's, like, the only time I actually go, all right, I'm not doing anything now for the next several hours. I'm going to play some games.
Yeah.
You know,
dedicated
it's time. It's a great social event. It's a great, you know.
Well, it can be both social, online, you know, of course, with online personalities, but then it's almost more fun, I think, in the way that you set it up, when you get together with friends and do it all together, because that way...
get a couple drunk guys to drive around and, what's that game? God, I'm just totally drawing a blank.
Need for Speed?
Yeah, Need for Speed Underground. Just watch people crash into walls, and oh man, just people start talking smack for days.
Well,
you know,
alcohol adds a completely different dynamic, but I think it go down in history is one of the worst, if not the worst, Halo 2 player on the planet.
I know.
People love playing with me because they just wipe the walls with my character.
Target practice, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah,
you
nice.
Know, I don't know what's going on. You know, I'm looking around. I'm like, oh, I think I can go this way. And then, bam, all of a sudden, I know I'm dead. Every once in a while, I get off a good shot. But, you know, unless you study these game guides. In fact, I was looking at, I was at a local game store the other day looking at the PC version of the Lego Star Wars game. And it was selling for like $30, which is pretty cheap. And I actually considered picking it up just because I had so much fun with the demo I played and playing the Game Boy version.
Right.
The game guide that I saw was $15, so it was half the cost of the actual game.
Right.
You know, at which point does the game guide become more expensive than the game itself? That's my question.
Right.
You know, and I remember, you know, you're talking about the Gold Zelda cartridges, you know, you really didn't need game guides. I mean, yes, they were kind of helpful with certain games like, you know, Castlevania or, you know, some of the more advanced RPGs, but you could usually get about, you know, a couple games within a magazine.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it wasn't that expensive to actually buy a game guide. And, of course, now it's just as easy to go through a walkthrough or download a text-based walkthrough online as it is to get a guide that costs half as much as the game does.
Right, right.
That's just my opinion. And I'm not a major gamer. I'm not the target market. But in seeing, you know, how much gaming has influenced everything, you know, all the way through popular culture, when we start to understand, and we obviously understand the names like Zelda and Mario and Sonic, you know, and Halo is also permeated our culture. I don't know if there are any necessary memorable characters, but at least you could say the name and you could automatically associate it with the Xbox brand.
Oh yeah, well, I think Mario is actually one of those, you know, forever brands. You know, more so because there's such a massive franchise that surrounded that. I mean, we joke about Pong, but then it's like, you know, Mario, everybody knows Mario. There were so many different versions of Mario, and, you know, seeing how many people would play it. What I found interesting, Tony B., one of my co-hosts on my show, brought up this issue where I guess one of, like, the editors of a popular game magazine was totally railing on the whole video mod thing that MTV does. And video mods, I just am fascinated with. They basically, music video, you know, music artists, MTV, whatever, they work out a relationship with the game developers to re-render the characters doing music video things, playing guitars, doing hip-hop things, and the novelty just hasn't worn off for me. And he's like, it totally cheapens the experience. I'm like, that doesn't make sense. How does it cheapen the experience of video games?
Well, it's the same idea of remixing and, you know, taking something that was seen one way and then doing something else with it.
Yeah, he was actually complaining about Blood Rain posing in Playboy. Like, how does that affect the game? That's like, that's like transcending the game and becoming pop culture. I mean, computer graphics are pretty impressive, and you know, and it's just totally like down on the idea that, oh well, you know, cheapens the game thing. I'm like, that's like saying cheats cheapen the game experience.
Oh, you always need cheats.
Oh my God, I just because I'm too lazy to go play everyone through on like Tekken 3 didn't mean, you know, I wanted the old drunk guy that kept falling down. He was actually a pretty vicious fighter, but you had to get the cheats and the unlocks or buy the little like Game Shark type things. I don't think it cheapens the experience at all. It makes me play more.
Well, it takes a lot of that frustration out of, you know, there's certain times where I want to accomplish everything. Like a game where I needed a walkthrough, an example would be Grim Fandango, which unfortunately, in my opinion, died an early death. It was a fantastic game. The music was fantastic. I still own the soundtrack. And it was part of, you know, getting drawn into it and the characters and the experience of it. I mean, I remember playing that at a 46. It was that long ago. But I had to use a walkthrough because it was so complicated, but I wanted to get through the game, but I didn't want to quit. So it drew me in, and I knew I had to cheat. I had to get a walkthrough in order to go through it, in order to get around a certain puzzle that I couldn't figure out. Because sometimes those puzzle games where you have to figure out a mystery or you have to stand in the right spot and, you know, do the hokey pokey and click this button and do all these fancy things that I don't understand how anybody could get, you know.
Do you ever remember the game? It came out on the Mac. It was called The Journeyman Project.
No.
This was actually one of the most advanced games, I think, of its day, because they just put so much QuickTime energy into it that you could
Was it pre-missed or post?
Huh?
Was it pre-missed or post?
I think it was simultaneous. Because you could run through hallways and then, like, look up and look down at any given time. It was like a really big deal to be able to have such a real-time fluid moment of everything. And I think they got some of the guys from Stone Sound, the guys that did the sound for Aeon Flux, the animated series, to do the sounds. So you would hear things like surrounding you, or if something was lurking around the corner as you got closer, the music would start to pick up and you could back. And it was just an excellent project. But they had one of those, like assembling DNA and all these bizarre projects mid-game. I mean, it was kind of like Myst in the sense that, you know, you walked around, but it was in real time. And I remember playing that one. It came on CD-ROM. Oh, this was an amazing game.
Well, I know that Lara Croft, another popular character, is getting a makeover.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. Apparently, they're kind of filling in some backstory there. And apparently, I guess the entire character, like visual, is getting a makeover as well.
Huh.
So I don't know if it's going to be good, bad, you know, somewhere in between. I guess I didn't really... I ended up playing, like, Tomb Raider 3, I think, and I played it for, like, a day, and I was like, yeah, okay, next.
Right.
Either a game really pulls me in immediately, or I just... I play it for, like, an hour, and then I'm, like, done.
Right, period. Right.
End of story.
I had a really fun experience some years ago. My wife worked for Walt Disney Imagineering. And so, of course, all of these guys are trying to figure out stuff to do with these games. And, you know, they would get, like, Tarzan and A Bug's Life. And, you know, they're looking to build rides. They're trying to do all the stuff. And they want to see how the game works. But they just don't even have gaming chops.
Wow.
So what we would do is they would buy the game. And then they'd send it home with her. And I'd play it all the way through to the end. You know, unlock what needed to be unlocked, just win the game. Save it all to a memory card, send my PlayStation and the game back so they could then start browsing around all these different levels. And then as a consulting fee, I like got the game. That's probably like the coolest video game job I've ever had to do. Because video game jobs, you know, testing is a brutal job, but that was so much fun to be able to play with all these games. And they were fun. You know, it's a good way to pass the time and build up a library.
Yeah, but what kind of games? If they were like Disney games, well, I suppose if you had kids.
Well, I didn't have kids at the time. No, I mean things like Tarzan and Bug's Life. I mean, it's very. I use Crash Bandicoot as like that you know, that example. It's just that kind of game. You know, run around, jump, do things. Of course, they've got a lot more money to invest in, you know, the things to render it and whatnot. So they're already doing that anyway. you know, so it was a pleasurable. You know, I'm not going to be like, God, let's play Bug's Life tonight. No, but it was enjoyable while I did it. You know, by the time I won the game, it's like, well, that's enough.
Yeah, you never wanted to see it again.
Yeah, I know, right.
You've got it in your library, but no, never again.
Yeah, exactly.
And of course, I suppose if I had to start over again in the industry, I probably would have chosen something in gaming, seeing that it's just one phenomenal industry. I mean, it's kicking Hollywood's butt, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah, and unlike Hollywood, the sequels in video games are actually better.
Yeah. Although, a few of them, not so much.
Yeah.
And a few of them you'd wish they would release sequels for, and then they never do. They die on the table.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Or they don't get promoted right. Or I mean, they're, case in point, and maybe you see the thread. Obviously, I'm a Star Wars fan, or at least used to be big time, but then kind of fell away from it after seeing The Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones. After the newness wore off, I started to realize, hey, wait, I got taken for a ride. I ended up playing the Phantom Menace game. You take these characters through the game, and you do these mini things, mini games within the game, and it builds up to, you know, the end game. And I found myself just frustrated. I kept lifting my head. The character, the way it would walk, you couldn't look up.
Right.
So if you wanted to see something that was ahead of you or whatever, you couldn't look up. And my neck ended up just hurting like hell because I kept craning my neck up to try to, and it would obviously not work. But have you ever seen the someone play a video game and they really get into it, like they move in the direction or they, you know, they're steering with their entire body?
Yeah, concentration tongue.
Oh man, yeah, exactly. It was a frustrating game, and I played it I beat it, you know, on my own, just to get through it, and it was such a disappointing experience. I mean, absolutely horrible. And I don't know if the game developer signed the game developer on again to do the other games, but it seems that you know, picking company is almost just as important, or the right development company, as getting the right story, as getting the right brand going.
Right, right.
And you know, obviously, I'm not. I wouldn't consider myself a pundit. Like I said, I'm not a gamer. You know, my experience with it has just been extremely limited, and I haven't had to, you know, necessarily watch anybody's habits, because I don't have kids, and Ponzi isn't much of a gamer at all. In fact,
yeah, if you get to that point where you have kids and, you know, you got a 4-year-old, trying to teach someone to play PlayStation is not easy. When you look at that controller,
oh yeah,
it's like, all right, now press up, down, R, no, that's R2, no, that's R1, no, not that one, that's start.
So wait a minute, so I thought, you know, the theory was that kids could actually run circles around adults when it came to this stuff.
We'll give them time, once they master it, yeah.
See, that's what I'm afraid of.
Yeah, it's, my 4-year-old had discovered a couple of bugs in Ant, the video blog aggregator for Mac and soon to be Windows. I videotaped him using it because of the novelty of, you know, we set up a bunch of kids safe video blog feeds because kids like watching other kids and fish tanks and dogs playing catch and all sorts of other stuff. And he knows we have a Mac and we run it in Simple Finder, which is a really stripped down and relatively indestructible version of Mac OS. It's just an option that you toggle on. And so, you know, he can only access a couple of things. He can have access to the video game, Finding Nemo, and then he can access Ant. And he was able to invoke the instance of the application twice. And, you know, so the developers, who actually had been over at my house and they'd seen him use it, they're now watching this video going, how the hell did he do that? And they just start clicking on things and acting in ways completely different from us, being so pure into it. You know, they do what they want to do.
Yeah, it seems that some people, when they would come over to my house, like way back when, they said, oh, you know, let me get on the computer. I said, no. I said, oh, don't worry, I don't know what I'm doing. I said, exactly.
Yeah.
It's like, you can mess something up, especially if you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah, yeah. And watching people double-click on website links.
Yeah.
Well, nobody exactly gave us an instruction manual for the Internet. We have to double-click on everything on our computers. Why wouldn't you double-click?
Yeah.
You know.
And I think there's a hack in Windows that can accidentally or detect accidental double clicks, which of course even Ponzi does it too. I'll see her double clicking a web page, which
yeah.
It's just like I tell her over and over again, you only need to single click it. but it doesn't matter. It's ingrained. It's like it's habit to double click things. So, and speaking of OS X, when are they releasing Tiger?
Oh, who knows? They said the first half. I mean, I'm thinking maybe late April, maybe May.
Oh boy.
You know.
Well, I know they froze the code recently, but my frustration is that I would really like to get a Mac Mini, and I know I could probably get it and get an upgrade discount or, you know, coupon for Tiger, but I just figure I'm just gonna wait until it's actually on the unit and then get it.
Yeah, usually the way that it works, and now, of course, there's no guarantee that Apple can do the same thing on a regular basis, but if you bought a computer and then within, like, a week or, you know, 20 days or something, they would offer a rebate so that it would ultimately cost you $20 to upgrade. They've done something similar in the past.
I'll just wait. I'm not in that much of a rush.
I don't know if you wait. Now, I'm in a rush because I want some of the features that are coming out in Tiger, namely the fact that they have this new video codec so that iChat, you know, the audio-video AIM client thing, instead of just having one-on-one video conferences, you can have up to three other people.
Wow.
You know, and it's all, like, hexagonal, right? So it's, like, one person on the side, one person in the middle, one person on either side. And then it, like, reflects a little bit because, you know, Apple will always show off their graphics engine. You know, a little reflection in real time and whatnot. I mean, there's lots of cool stuff going on with the iChat. I was actually just doing a TV show in New York over iChat. And I was actually, like, blue-screened on the back wall behind the host. And it was very George Orwell. I felt like somebody was going to walk in and beat me in the head with a sledgehammer. But there's so many cool things. There's like an iChat recorder so you can record video conference, and there's all sorts of fun stuff to do.
Well, I know that I had an iSight and had an iMac, but I sold them recently. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was like one of the first iLamps that was out, and it was already outdated. And then, you know, I considered, well, should I get a newer iMac? And then, of course, then they announced the Mac Mini, and I was like, even better option, because then I don't need to buy another monitor, since I've already got a monitor that has dual inputs.
Yeah, I was kind of annoyed by that, because I just bought a 17-inch iMac, the new panel.
Ah, dude.
Whatever. Surprisingly, I was not too thrilled with it. Doing stuff like GarageBand for audio.
Why?
And some iMovie stuff, it seemed to work harder than my PowerBooks did.
Is the hardware any better or worse?
Well, technically it's better, and I would think there would be some G5 optimization. I could be wrong about that, but it just seemed to really struggle a lot more, and I actually ran into more issues using these applications on this particular G5.
You think it was the hardware or the...
I don't know. Maybe it's just a combination of both. I mean, it is jammed in there. You know, so I'm still on my PowerBook, and I'm probably not in any hurry to get a G5 laptop when and if they come out.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure it's inevitable, but I'm just, you know.
That was probably the biggest surprise for me, is that the Mac Mini, they're still G4s.
Yeah, I mean, I think the specs on the Mac Mini are very similar to one of the basic iBooks. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, it's nice that they're actually getting into a market that makes sense. And I think their plan is working. You know, all these people have iPods. They're already spending $400 or $500. And then you go, well, you know, far from it, I'll just play around with it. I mean, I have so many PC friends that are like, you know, I'm just thinking about, you know, $500. I'll just go ahead and do it. It's like, yeah, watch it. This is how it starts.
Yeah, but then even having it, and after having the iMac around for a while, there are certain things that I found that I just couldn't deal with. I mean, you know, even though it was cool and the uniqueness of the experience, you know, having never really used a Mac before,
yeah.
It was definitely exciting to see a lot of the software that was being released for the Mac platform, specifically OS X. And, of course, this is like right when it came out, when the first iLamp iMacs came out. That's when I really kind of decided to jump aboard. In fact, the day I went, I met Steve Jobs. He was at the Palo Alto store.
Oh, yeah.
And shook his hand and introduced myself briefly, and he said, great, buy an iMac with SuperDrive. I said, okay, no problem.
Too funny. Yeah, the only, I mean, I'm a cross-platform guy. I absolutely adore my HP laptop. It's got so many features on it, you know, operating system notwithstanding. It's a laptop a Mac user can love. But what pisses me off is having to go back from using the command key, the Apple Cloverleaf key.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah,
then
yeah.
Going to control, which you never use on a Mac, rarely.
It's hard to get used to the different shortcuts. I have that issue too. Well, even with laptops, they don't put some of them, like my IBM ThinkPad doesn't have a Windows key, so I have to remap it. And as a Windows user, I use the Windows key religiously.
Right.
And I mean, because it is very useful for certain keyboard shortcuts that are universal. So, like, you know, Windows R will open up the run command dialog, and Windows E opens up Explorer window, Windows F find, and all these, you know, fancy schmancy things that I can use. And unfortunately, a lot of laptop manufacturers specifically, you really don't see it with a lot of the keyboard manufacturers. They won't put a Windows key on there. So even that experience gets interrupted within the same platform.
Yeah, I'm a big page down, page up, home and end user. And I have an external keyboard connected to my laptop. You know, my laptop sits on my desk and is connected to like 50 billion things, you know, my mixer, my hard drives and all that. And I use that religiously. And then on the laptop, it's compressed. That's one thing I certainly appreciate about PC laptops. And then you're starting to get companies that are putting 10 keypads, like some of HP's.
Yeah.
And I think Toshiba has one, where they've got a 10 key, which is very handy. It's just like you can use a 10 key in a different way than actually hunting and pecking for, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 up on the top row.
Well, usually they'll have it so that it's like you can toggle it with like a function key or a numlock, and it's actually built into the keyboard, if that's what you mean.
Like, yeah, that's what the Mac does, but the PCs generally will have its own. Granted, it'll be some weird place, like on the upper right in this vertical
pattern.
It's at least there, and you can train yourself.
Yeah, I never got used to the 10 key. Never needed to.
Yeah, it all depends on what you use it for. I do have a tendency of doing a lot of number stuff, unfortunately.
Oh, you mean accounting wise, or
always having just rattle off numbers.
Just randomly, you just feel the need, or
yes, it's a way to pass time. It's a stress reliever. You know, that's how I avoid playing video games. I just use 10 keys.
Well, I suppose that's one way to look at it.
Yeah, there you go.
In fact, my dad used to say that he could run circles around the people who were using Windows. He was still using DOS. I think it was like Lotus 1-2-3. He's an accountant, and he was right. I mean, once you learn how to navigate with the keyboard, it's horrible to go back to the mouse.
Oh, yeah.
You can't do it. In fact, you know, my reliance on the mouse is very minimal. I only use it if I'm navigating within a window, like a browser window or an email client. But for the most part, if I can stick on the keyboard, I do.
Yeah.
It's just so quick.
I love shortcuts. Shortcuts are just like a tremendous way to go.
Yeah, like control, I don't know if there's a Mac equivalent, but control backspace to delete the word that you're currently on. Just the word.
I've never tried that.
Oh, dude, that is such a time saver. Instead of going bam, 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 bam on the backspace key, you know, you literally just control backspace, and it, you know, clears the entire word. And then, of course, I think, I'm not doing it right now, but I think control shift backspace clears the line. It's been a while since I've done that. Usually it's control backspace. It's almost essential.
It's option delete.
Option delete?
Yeah.
Boy.
That deletes the backwards word. Now, you said what, shift control?
I think control backspace on the PC should, in the application that supports it, and most of them do, should delete the word that comes before it or the word that you're currently on.
Right. I can't delete the entire line. I'm only doing the words, but it's option delete. So there you go. There's a little Mac tip of the day to delete a word. That's like the most trivial thing ever.
Well, I know, but all those small things add up. You'd be surprised at how many people still don't know cut, copy, and paste.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it took me a while. Ponzi, we use a NewsGator for our news aggregators, and she would click one entry in, like, it's in like an Outlook folder. She would click one entry, and then she would, you know, click each individual entry. I said, no. First of all, I hit Control A. That does select all, and that's very important. So select all, and then press delete. She would actually click each individual one and you'd have to do it selectively. You have to hold on the Control key. You click one thing, select one item, and you hold on a Control, and you can do items selectively. So she'd be doing that, and then I showed her, you know, clicking one item and then clicking clicking one item at the bottom, holding onto the shift key and clicking an item on top, and that selects the range.
And it's so slow to watch somebody do that.
It's painful. painful. It's painful. Because it just saves so much time. I mean, I've got it down to an art. You know, Control-A, delete. Control-A, delete. Control-A, delete.
Yeah.
You know, it's just... And I never touch the mouse. And just to see how much time could be saved, you know, by using keyboard shortcuts. And
I think you'll also find that there's also a good deal of Mac users that really... I mean, now that we've got Alt-Tab equivalent, you know... Alt-Tab and then Alt-Escape or Alt-Tilde will, like, cycle through the windows
yep.
in an open application. And so, yeah, once you start getting the Command-A or the Control-ACV, Alt-Tab, Control, page down, page down, I mean, you can fly
yeah.
doing stuff.
And it's I think I caught... I mean, I very seldom do I find Macs, other than people who don't care about computers, very seldom do I find Macs that don't have two-button mice attached to them, mouses
oh, yeah.
and mices. Most of them being the Microsoft mouse, I'll see on a lot of Macs, just because of the scroll wheel functionality, and once you have that, it works natively in OS X.
Yes, I have a Logitech MX510. I actually bought it prior to the Laser 1000 coming out. I think it's technically like a 9-button mouse. I use the scroll wheel extensively, but the feature of Exposé, which will tile all of the windows, or tile just the windows in an application, just momentarily so you can see them at a glance, and then you can roll over and then let go, and that will bring it to the foreground. That's probably what I miss the most when I go back to the PC or something. And you can map it to all of these commands. So... You know, if you're looking at a typical multi-button mouse, it's like by my thumb, where my thumb sits, there are two buttons. You know, one of those will do like an F9. I've got it mapped to F9. The other one mapped to like F10. And then I have like a little scroll up right above the scroll wheel to get rid of everything on and show me the desktop at a moment's notice.
Wait a minute. You said that you picked it up before, what did you say, a laser mouse?
Well, the Logitech then came out. I think the... upgrade to the MX510, which was a gaming darling. I mean, a lot of people love this mouse for gaming. They came out with the MX1000 laser. I don't know if it's a real laser or what, but that's just how they bill it.
Yeah,
it's in the silver packaging. It's like $100 or something. That is even more responsive.
Jeez.
It's like triple the DPI.
Wow.
You know, I mean, well, I think the name 1000 might come from it having
the
1000
response.
DPI.
Yeah.
Because I think this Logitech is like 800.
Well, that's pretty good.
Yeah, it's
you know,
real well.
I've always had a lot of luck with the Microsoft series of mice. I mean, very seldom will I have issues. The current one that I've got, though, the Intel Mouse Explorer Pro with the tilt wheel. First of all, I'm not very impressed with the tilt wheel. Don't waste your time, money, or energy on the tilt wheel technology. It's not worth it.
But you can't get anything else, though, can you?
No, you can get other things.
Not that don't have the tilt, that sideways.
Yeah, at this point you can. I mean, I'm sure eventually it's going to be in every Microsoft mouse, but it's in my opinion, it's way overhyped. Not that it had been hyped at all, just I don't think it's that fantastic, and it doesn't really work great. Just because I really don't do a lot of sideways scrolling, and when I do, it's painful. Sideways scroll, so it's just as quick to use the mouse. And there's no real need to have the tilt wheel. If it worked quicker, it'd be better. But
one of the form functions I really love with the Microsoft mouse is the one that's on the Bluetooth mouse. And the Microsoft Bluetooth mouse, it just fits like the best pair of shoes for my hand. You know, obviously you can't recommend a mouse because that's like me telling you what shoes are going to be comfortable in your feet. You know, your mileage may vary. But the thing is, I'm really skeptical about getting a Bluetooth mouse, only because I know that there's some quirkiness with the Microsoft Bluetooth mouse and all the Mac stuff that's got Bluetooth on it. And even though I love the Logitech wired mice, some of their wireless mice are just a little odd.
Yeah, I haven't really caught on to the whole wireless mouse thing at this point in time, wireless keyboard or mouse. I'm still very much into the whole cord thing, USB thing. I'll check out the Logitech, although I've heard the Logitech mouse drivers can be a little wonky on Windows. So.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I don't like the typical cordless mouse, but I do like Bluetooth mice. I think just because I've been spoiled having Bluetooth built in. That's also one of the cool things that I love about my PC laptop. I have an HP DV1040, and this has Bluetooth on it. But that's just like one of the features that makes this laptop to me so impressive. I mean, HP basically came out with this entertainment notebook. Now, it's not a Media Center PC. They have Media Center notebooks. This one is a 14-inch WXGA screen. It's got their bright view screen, so it's shiny, and so things look a little more vivid. It has like 512 megs of RAM. I think it's got like a 60-gig hard drive. It's got 802.11g. It has a remote control that is stored in the PC card slot.
Wow.
For like PowerPoint. And then it's got like two headphone jacks on the front and a microphone jack.
Holy cow.
Yeah, and it's got the new design of the touchpad kill. And then it's got something called QuickPlay, which is actually a Linux-powered server, which means that you can take a DVD, put it into your drive, hit the DVD button, and it boots up as a DVD player, bypasses Windows completely.
Yeah, yeah, which is a smart way to go.
Yeah, so having a Centrino processor and all that, you're getting even better battery life.
Yeah.
What was so amazing about it was the price point. It was like $14.99.
Wow.
And that was like, and it's thin and it's light. And that's one thing that, you know, Apple can do somehow, and I don't know how they do it, but, you know, you look at small Sony laptops, and they cost like $2,000 plus just for an ultralight notebook. I think this thing weighs in at about 5 pounds.
That's not
and it's
too bad.
It actually fits in the 15-inch Brent Haven bag, and the Brent Haven bags were designed for PowerBooks. They fit them to the T.
Hmm.
It pushes out the little insert just a little bit, but, you know, I just recycled an old Brent Haven to have, store all my HP stuff for when I do PC things.
You know, I to touch upon the Bluetooth and then moving on, I think what has made a lot of techies reluctant to adopt Bluetooth as far as, like, keyboard and mice are concerned on Windows is that you don't have access to them on boot up. I mean, like, you can't get to them until the stack is loaded.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even after it's loaded, I've yet to see a very pleasing UI on the Bluetooth stack. It looks horrible. And,
yeah,
you know, quite honestly, is not user-friendly. And if Microsoft doesn't do a better job at making it a better experience out of the box without having to rely on all these screwed-up drivers, it's never going to catch on, at least on the Windows platform.
I have no experience with it on the Mac platform. It's just not been a priority.
Oh, Bluetooth?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's really no point. I mean, unless you really, really need something, or, you know, if something's wrong with USB or any other kind of, you know, local connectivity, you know, I've always thought and believed and have always seen that, you know, a wired connection is always going to be quicker or easier or less flaky than any kind of wireless connection, no matter what you're running.
Yeah, and plus a child can steal the mouse and hide it. Or
and bingo.
Who got my mouse?
Well, Ponzi's got one of the HPs, the Media Centers or whatnot, and with the wireless connectivity. And it's not Bluetooth. It's just just a regular old, quote-unquote, wireless keyboard and mouse. But she likes that because she doesn't like cords. But, you know, there's no way I'm going to be spending, you know, any amount of money on, you know, something that she doesn't need. I mean, there's no inherent value in having a Bluetooth wireless mouse and keyboard. It's just, other than the uniqueness of saying, hey, I've got a Bluetooth mouse and keyboard, there's really
yeah, right.
no need.
Right, right.
And that's in, you know, in my opinion.
Yeah, I tend to agree with it.
You know, even she's got a Pocket PC with, or I'm sorry, a Windows mobile device, and it's got Bluetooth on it, and she got it specifically so that she could use a wireless headset, but I never see her using it. Why?
That's actually a smart use. I can really appreciate Bluetooth for that. I used the HP 6315 at an event. I was demoing it, like, all day, and I had this great $99 Motorola headset. In fact, I was so worried that it was going to be, like, stolen or lost because it's so small. But that I am always getting tangled up with my seatbelt, and I have one of the Jabra headsets for my Motorola.
Oh, yeah, the Jabra.
Yeah, and it just that's a very smart use of it. I'm pretty stoked about that.
Huh. Yeah, I had the. I think she's got the Motorola one, the one you're talking about.
Yeah, it looks like just a little like shell or
yeah.
or something.
Yeah, it looks like something out of Star Trek. I had the Jabber one for a brief while, and then I took the Pocket PC back. I returned it. I had it for like a day, and then I realized, this kind of sucks.
Yeah.
So I took it back. I mean, the headset and the actual unit. I didn't upgrade at all.
Yeah, well, there's a lot going on with these units that, you know, if they got Wi-Fi, especially like the 6215, surprisingly the battery life is fairly decent considering how many radios are in the damn thing. The screen's not as bright as it should be. That was one of my gripes about the thing. But overall, I mean...
Honestly, I'm trying to watch my pattern with the Pocket PC, and I usually use it to check email, but once you download, like, 100 messages through IMAP on the Pocket Outlook, it becomes unresponsive. So I'm considering, you know, possibly looking at some of the next-gen smartphones and actually moving to that particular platform instead of, you know, sticking with the Pocket PC. I think I'm ready.
The smartphone I'm waiting for from my provider is coming one of these years.
Wait, who's your provider?
Nextel, and it's all about the i930, which has been promised for, like, you know, 50 years. It's like, hello, can we come out with it already?
Well, see, I've been pretty happy with Verizon. I mean, they're not, I don't know if they're the best one out there. But, you know, they seem to have been the least of all evils that I could ever find or use.
Yeah, I got hooked up with Nextel because I had a lot of friends that worked there, so I got a killer deal on rate plans and everything. And the Direct Connect is actually a pretty vital part of... It's like an instant message for the phone. And, you know, Motorola's phones, they've always been big on the Nextel service because all the radio stuff in there. But now it's starting to take shape. I mean, the i860 phone that I have, I mean, it's just a gorgeous phone. It's just, I know, hang on to it, and yeah, it's very text interface, you know, and I can get my email and whatnot, and it's got a camera phone and it records video, but I just want the Windows mobile phone whenever, you know, they decide to release it.
You know, that's one of the things that, you know, I had to watch for, too, is, like, which service provider had the best Pocket PC, and I was using... You know, just an old Nokia, you know, before I leaped to this, I think it was a 3670 or something like that, you know, one of the first camera phones. And it was great. And I also had a Pocket PC, and I also had a Palm device, and I realized, I never use them. I'm only using my cell phone. So I realized in order to stick with, you know, a PDA, I would have to go with something that was, you know, PDA and a phone. So that's the only way I would have, you know, I've got a Samsung i700 at this point, which, you know, is about a generation or so old. But it works for the most part, but it is bulky, and I'm thinking that I'm probably about a year away from moving to the smartphone, but I see no reason, you know, to leap away from having, you know, things like the ability to do a lot of Microsoft-centric stuff on the phone.
Now, actually, that's a very interesting question I got for you. Of course, it's probably, I'm a bit of an oddball. You know, here I am a Mac user, but I love the Pocket PC. I love the Windows Mobile platform, and I have to buy a $40 app. I sacrifice some functionality, but I gain a lot more that's tied into the Mac. You're, of course, much more of a Microsoft person. Why not Palm? You know, I should be a Palm user because Palm and Apple, you know, peas and carrots, that kind
of
thing.
Well, not always peas and carrots. Ask a few people. I ended up selling my UX50 to somebody, and they picked it up and were trying to get it to work with OS X, and they couldn't do it. They just couldn't, no matter how much
Sony,
software.
Though, isn't it?
Yeah, it was Sony.
Yeah, Sony, which is, I think, a Japanese word for, must be Thursday, let's discontinue a product and come out with something new.
Pretty much. Well, now they've completely abandoned the entire Clié line.
In America.
Yeah, in America. And yeah, I'm not surprised. But I ended up buying the UX50 because it was pretty slick. I mean, it did a lot of really cool things.
Oh yeah, the form and, function on some of those things, form factors are just like,
dude, it was amazing. It was amazing. But I never used it, and I ended up having to buy all the software or use all the software that it just worked with the Pocket PC. I'm like, well, why am I trying to make this work like a Pocket PC? I should be using a Pocket PC. So for me, you know. I just, you know, the Palm is just so outdated. I mean, the operating system, as much as they try to push it forward, still kind of sucks. Mm-hmm. It's the degree that it sucks. I find that the living in Outlook on the desktop, I use Outlook 2000, it makes so much more sense to use a Pocket PC or a smartphone because all my tasks, all my notes, all my, you know, my calendar, and most importantly, my contacts are automatically synchronized.
Yeah.
And I am done with the hell of having one contact list on my phone and another on my computer. I'm done.
Right.
And so for that reason alone, that's why I'm serious about, you know, sticking with the Windows Mobile platform in, you know, whichever one happens to be the best option for what I get. So, you know, part of what I look at when I get a cell phone is how well is it going to integrate with my desktop experience. And, you know, a large part of that is answered by the Pocket PC platform inherently. And not to say that there aren't applications, you know, for Palm users that would allow you to, you know, synchronize data back and forth between PIMs or the desktop. But I just found myself wanting and longing for the functionality of the Pocket PC just because it was already there. It was built in. You didn't have to worry about it. The software, right. It worked.
And for most people, it's a familiar operating interface.
Yeah. And even so, I mean, it's not that much, that difficult to use a Pocket. If you can use any kind of cell phone, you can use a Pocket PC.
Sure.
It's not, you know, so dramatically different. I mean, even if you live in OS X, it's not going to be an interruptive experience that, you know, causes you to say, oh, I can't use this phone, I don't know how to use it, or this Pocket PC, this device, this PDA.
Right.
So, you know, for me, that's the reason why I didn't go Palm. Or was it just were you asking a question specifically to me or just in general?
Just asking in general, you know, what makes Pocket PC? And I think you actually answered that. I'm curious to see if there's going to be any more advancements with Palm. Peter and I, when we were recording the Engadget podcast today, we were talking about the Trio 650, but also this rumored LifeDrive, you know, 4-gig kind of tungsten-looking Palm thing that's allegedly, you know, coming out, that slipped out on an Amazon page, you know, and so it's like, who knows?
You know, I'm done. I've tried different Palms throughout the years, and see here, I started, the first Palm I had, I won a Palm 7 by dressing up like Carmen Miranda, and I still have that picture, I think it's on Flickr. Then I won the Palm 7, so I used that, you know, I think that had, what, was it 2 megabytes of RAM, and it had, of course, the wireless service. That's the reason why I wanted to use it.
Yeah.
You know, it had the flip-up antenna and everything. And then I ended up buying the Palm, I think, what was it, the 5X? I thought it was a lot, you know, slicker, so I ended up buying that, but I never really used it. And, you know, the software that was there is just kind of like, well, this is kind of weird. And then I kind of walked away from it not long after I got it because, you know, the software was just kind of wonky, and then every once in a while, it would just decide to make everything disappear.
Oh.
And just reset itself like nothing ever happened. Like, I just bought it. Like, I just opened it out of the box. No data or anything. You know, clean slate, which
is... Well, I have a great backup PDA. It's a little Moleskine notebook.
A what?
A Moleskine notebook. A little leather-bound notebook for those emergencies to carry pen and paper.
See, but that... It shouldn't be that way. And quite honestly, I'm sure, you know, Palm apologists will sit there and say, oh, well, you know, well, no, nothing's perfect. Yeah, but I've seen it happen way too many times, and it's happened to me way too many times. I mean, ask Ponzi about her experience with it.
Sure, yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It was a nightmare. And if it's not reliable, it's not reliable, period. And I haven't seen any improvements in that space, quite honestly.
Yeah, that's kind of my Windows experience. That's why I've just... You
yeah.
know, ultimately, there's no difference between Mac and Windows, but I am a slob with my Mac, and it just doesn't do anything bad to me.
See, I've been close at some points in the past when I've run into problems with Windows. I've come really close to, you know, jumping. What usually keeps me from doing it is, you know, having the experience I had with OS X. It just didn't seem to... have a complete, it'd be a complete experience for me in how I used it and how I wanted to use it.
Right, right.
And, you know, I found it more frustrating. I found it enjoyable, but I found it frustrating in the way I found Windows to be a lot faster. And so that's, you know, really what kind of kept me from moving, you know, completely over to the white side of the operating system world, galaxy, if you will.
In a land. Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, it's a question that I think everybody faces, but you ultimately have to decide what, you know, what's your comfort level, what do you want to do, what do you want to use it for, and what makes you frustrated, and which one is going to frustrate you less.
Right, right.
So for new users, I'm all about recommending OS X because that's one less support call I have to take, you know, with spyware or, you know, some crappy application that accidentally gets installed, a toolbar.
There are some Mac users that got a racket going on, man. They're like, yeah, I have a Mac. And what do you do for a living? I repair PCs.
Exactly.
Ka-ching!
It's so true. It's very true. It's so frustrating to have to install. I think I've got, well, at least I have Microsoft's anti-spyware app, which of course was recently acquired by or from Giant Software.
Is your boy Matt Hartley, is he a Mac guy, even though he fixes PCs?
I think he uses both. And in fact, he's a big Linux fanatic as well. So, you know, he's kind of unbiased as far as all that goes.
Right.
And, I think in seeing how I have to protect people, it's just easier to take the path of least resistance and say, here, just use the Mac and be done with it and walk away and not have to worry about installing. In fact, I think I've seen the .Mac service has some type of antivirus thing. What's the point?
Yeah, it's a Virex.
Yeah, what's the point?
Well, yeah, I mean, don't throw caution completely to the wind.
Well, yeah, but until it becomes a nail that's worth being pounded, it's not going to get pounded.
I'll admit, I don't think on my new laptop I have it installed, but, you know, it's...
It's, oh my God, it's you're buying into the fear. I mean, that's the one thing I would never probably think of installing on OS X is an anti-spyware application or, you know, anything that protects me from viruses.
But Mac and Windows users together can come together and agree that Norton Utilities is the biggest piece of bloatware,
dude.
No matter
yes,
what.
I totally agree. I haven't installed anything Symantec or Norton since Norton Commander years ago.
Oh, my God.
It's horrible, dude.
It's same thing on the Mac. Same thing on the Mac. It's hilarious. But I used to be really, you know, us against them kind of zealot on the Mac until I realized, you know what, I can make double the money by being smart on both operating systems.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's ultimately, you know, when OS X really started, you know, getting a lot of attention, I was like, you know, I really didn't like OS 9. I thought it really sucked. And even some people who are into OS 10 say, yeah, OS 9 just kind of sucked. And I said, yes, I was saying this years ago. But seeing the elegance of OS 10 is really what attracted me to it. And then I realized, it'd be good to know kind of how to get around, you know, some of the major applications, how to work with things, how it works differently. Mm-hmm. And that's really what drove me to getting the iMac originally.
Right.
And then ultimately, you know, I sold it just because I wasn't really using it anymore, and it was just kind of, it lost a lot of its charm. And then, of course, seeing, you know, some of the things they're working on for Tiger, I was like, this will be good to pick up again. I think this will be fun.
Yeah. Who knows? Maybe we'll have a $199 Mac Mini.
Right.
The iPod Shuffle is actually the next Mac platform.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it. I mean, Apple might as well rename their company.
Yeah, I.
Yeah, just that's it.
I.
Just
that's
it.
It.
Yeah, just a super, super simple. Yeah, there are certain things that I think Microsoft develops better software for OS X than Apple develops for Windows, that's for sure.
I'm actually just going to say it because I say this everywhere. I really wish Microsoft would bring back the Windows Media Encoder for the Mac.
Dude,
I would be making Windows Media videos, and probably so would a lot of the, you know, I'm really tight with the video blog community. Hello? Just because it's a small market share doesn't mean we don't produce, you know, like 80% of the content. We'd probably produce stuff, and he took it away, and I'm not really interested in buying a $400 application called Cleaner or whatever else, you know, and it's just, God, that's so aggravating.
Yeah, I know what you mean. In fact, I think they've disbanded the team for the encoder for the Windows platform as well, so it could be, you know, cross-platform, so don't feel like you're the only one who's asking for updates.
Well, see, the thing is, though, is that Movie Maker on XP does output to WMV.
Yeah.
And I actually just started doing a lot of video work just because I don't have a lot of experience there, and so it's like dive in head first and just do it. You know, same basic experience. You know, Movie Maker to iMovie. iMovie is a better piece of software.
Oh, my God. Light years better.
Yeah, but Movie Maker does the trick.
It does the job, but it looks horrible. It's like dating the ugly sister. you know, I feel dirty every time I use it. And, you know, I'm pretty vocal about it, too. I use Movie Maker on a semi-regular basis. I'm a digital media MVP for Microsoft.
Right.
And, you know, I've told them from day one, I'm like, no, this sucks, and here's why. The UI is just, it's horrible. I mean, like, I the amount of mistakes that they made with the UI... it just oversights, and it's absolutely inelegant. And Microsoft's not the only one, you know, to blame for this. A lot of people who develop for Windows do a horrible job when it comes to UI. I mean, really horrible. I mean, just you wonder what the hell they were thinking. Nick Bradbury, author of Feed Demon and Top Style and Homesite, was one of the first software designers that I think, you know, got it right on a consistent basis. You know, the UI that he's always, you know, put forth has always been really, really smart, really intuitive, really good, really clean. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are very few people who can boast that, because programmers usually do things just for function. And I think that's where OS X kind of comes and cleans up. Like, every Java applet I've ever run on OS X looks great. I can't say the same for anything on Windows.
Right, right.
And it really makes that UI experience just absolutely just amazing. And I find that that's probably one of the things that draws me to, you know, OS X and using OS X utilities more so than, you know, Windows counterparts is that experience. Now, you know, that being said, I didn't really use iMovie too much because I didn't really, you know, output to DVD. And right. I'm not big on the QuickTime format. I don't use QuickTime.
Well, actually, I've been spending a lot of my time now, in addition to outputting to QuickTime, I export to AVI quite a bit, and sometimes MPEG, and the 3GP is not too bad.
See, I'm big. Anytime I output to video, 9 times out of 10, it's Windows Media.
Yeah.
Just because it always seems to run, you know, as far as Windows is concerned, runs clean. And even when I load the stuff onto OS X, I can play Windows Media files without a problem.
I actually don't have as much luck. I kind of find that when you launch a Windows Media file on Mac, you just kind of step back away from the computer and don't even look at the computer because it's just going to make it not degrade gracefully.
Really?
Yeah, sometimes. I was just watching. Jeff Jarvis actually just did a video blog, and it just took me like 5 times to get it to play right. And like, all right, I'm going to shrink it. I'm going to start it over. I'm going to hit play. I'm going to rewind it. See what happens, and then the audio is doing all this stuff. And
see, you know, ultimately, I think the solution for all that stuff is Flash.
Well, I'm okay with that.
Well, no, just think about it. Like, Flash, you don't need anything. I mean, Flash is the wrapper. You know, you throw the video file into Flash, and it'll play. It'll play on Linux. It'll play on OS X. It'll play in Windows. It's just universal. It's a universal file format. You're not screwing around with all these codecs and all this whatnot. It doesn't matter. Just throw it.
You're screwing around with the codecs. I mean, that's one thing that we do at Audioblog is, you know, you can record directly into Flash video format.
Yeah, but
you know, we're also starting to support all these different file formats for uploading. Oh yeah, there are some file formats under the hood that are just nasty.
Right, but that's what I'm saying is, like, you don't have to. The user doesn't have to worry about it. Now, the person who's actually putting it together, the encoder, yes, I'm sure has to worry about it. But the ultimate, you know, the output, you know, the end game is having this file that just works. You know, I don't want to have to explain to someone, oh, you need to download the XVID codec in order to play this file. I mean, that's just stupid. It's asinine to expect anybody to go to those lengths to get videos to work. And with Flash, it's there. It's inherent. It just
yeah,
works.
Like 97% penetration of them.
Oh, dude, it might as well be 100% at that point. You know, unless you're talking with purists, in which case they probably don't have anything like XVID or DivX or any of the fancy video or audio codecs installed on their system. So there is no point.
Right. Absolutely.
So, but anyway, I probably sucked up enough of your time.
Oh, just a late night, just kind of browsing through email and
yeah, me too.
Letting the things happen.
Yeah, me too. For the most part.
Well, I'm looking forward to Gnomedex, man.
Oh yeah, it ought to be good. Shaping up.
Well, and also Seattle's one of my my favorite towns.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How favorite is it?
I know where you're going with this. Well, okay. obviously, I have a summer to work with, right? Because you
sure.
know, when kids are on break and whatnot, I actually found an opportunity to move into a really cool house south of Silicon Valley.
Oh,
not exactly a place down, you know, in the South County that I'd want to live, but it gives me the opportunity to build a little bit of a soundstage, build a studio, and it's like trying to, you know, I just can't stop working. That's the tricky part of it. I mean. You know, a couple small companies that, you know, we both, my wife and I run, and it's just like, oh, God, moving across. We've already done that. I mean, we've moved across country once and then back. And his moving takes a lot of... I mean, you saw that. You moved from just L.A. up to
Seattle.
It
can suck.
You know, it's one of those... You know, life... There is actually a lot of time in life. You'll say, well, life is short. But I don't know. Some people, oh, yeah, we lived there for 10 years, you know. I lived in Florida for 3 years. That was a pretty good experience and different, and I'm glad to be back in California. And it is really tough sometimes to leave California, but...
You know, once you come to Seattle, I'm telling you, it's a... Well, at least it called to me, and, you know, I answered that call, and I haven't regretted it. In fact, I think Gnomedex is reaping the benefits of it. It's this year is just going along so wonderfully, so smoothly, you know, unlike Gnomedexes of years past. And, you know, we've got, well, I mean, if our blog roll is any indication, we've got 58 people who have blogs who are in the blog roll.
Nice.
And, of course, we've got a max of about 300 attendees for Gnomedex, so we're definitely getting there.
And it's going to be one hell of a podcast feed, too, if people go podcast crazy.
Oh, dude. Yeah, of course, I've let people, I'm letting people, I'm like, if you whatever they wanted to record at Gnomedex is fine. We're probably going to be grabbing a feed off the main soundboard.
So you know, I'm not going to be podcasting.
Oh, no?
No, I'm going to be video blogging.
Oh!
Podcasting is so last week. What, are you kidding me? Well, because think about it. Is podcasting covered? Yes.
Yeah, it's covered.
I don't, you know, so let's get some, and I think some video bloggers from New York are going to be coming out, and so that's going to be cool because
wow.
There's a different kind of magic that happens on video. I mean, I want to give you a dirty look. I don't know how to say that on a podcast.
Yeah. Well, and the funny thing is, I mean, this is one of the reasons, you know, we're working with sponsors now, and unfortunately I can't announce any because we're still kind of in negotiations. But it's definitely, I mean, we're doing very, very well in terms of sponsorship, or at least we're set to be. And one of the things that we're going to be working on this year is you know, signage, because I know there are going to be so many people taking pictures, videoing, and all that stuff. So we're going to be very strategic in the signage just to make sure, you know, that the sponsors get their due. And that's the one thing that I've said for people who have asked me, hey, can I podcast? Can I, you know, can I record? Can I do this or that? And I said, yes, as long as you give attribution. Like, you did it at Gnomedex. It was sponsored by X, Y, and Z. Then, you know, they're happy, and then I don't get in trouble, and I don't have to come down on anybody.
Well, that's fair, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is. It's only fair. I mean, if we put together this venue and you're bringing all these people there, then it just makes sense. And I think by the time this airs, this particular interview airs, I will have announced it, but our second keynote is going to be Dave Weiner. And I say second because we had announced Adam first, but Dave Weiner is also going to be doing something in the keynote type of space at Gnomedex. So, yeah, it's turning into quite a good event from all sorts of perspectives. And oddly enough, a lot of our attendees, the people who signed up thus far, have been coming from California.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but Seattle, I mean, I know I'm going to be spending plenty of time in Seattle. There are so many close friends of mine that are up in that area that it's just like, you know, it's a god. And it's so close to Vancouver, too. Maybe some people can come down from north of the border.
Oh, yeah. There will be.
You know, summertime, and it's a very scenic city, and being video, you know, you start paying attention to the aesthetics, going, let's all just stand outside and look ominous in front of this tall building.
Well, you know, Seattle is just, in fact, I talked to a guy tonight who has been a guy who's been pretty connected. He runs a website called iloveseattle.org, and we were talking about how a lot of people from Seattle are doing these great things, but no one's talking to each other. So Seattle has a horrible time at promoting the things that it itself does, or the people themselves do.
Got to rally the troops to get a video blog community going on out there, because that's the one thing of seeing it. Like when Scoble did his little silly tourist video.
Yeah.
That was awesome, because I missed Seattle, and it was great to see his wife, and it's just all this stuff. It was like, that's just wonderful. I mean, there's so much cool stuff to look at.
You know, the thing was, I was doing video blogging, like, way back when. In fact, I've got tons of videos that are still online that I used to do every single week for Locker Gnome, and I just kind of, I kind of gave it up. And as a matter of fact, it's one of the reasons why I got a digital camera that had the movie capability, so that I could upload these little videos to the web with relative ease. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people can enjoy me watching paint dry or some, you know, whatever the hell it happened to be for that week. But it's something I've considered, you know, picking up again.
Well, it doesn't have to be for everybody. I mean, you can just make videos for your friends and family, you know, and that's cool because that's relevant content.
Yeah,
it cracks me up when all these people start bragging on various forms of media. It's just like, well, who died and made you God? You know, judge all. I mean, thank you for being Letterman and providing the top 10 list of everything that is cool and true and, you know, give me a break. Do it. I mean, just do it for whatever. I mean, I ran into people because, you know, I'm driving this movement for kids to video blog and kids, you know, people video blogging, kids safe content, and some people that don't have kids are like, well, I don't know anything about kids. I'm like, go film a waterfall. Go film a fish tank. I guarantee I will be hearing that waterfall 15 million times a day because my kid loves it so much. And just little things. I mean, seeing, you know, it's like I got this window. I have such this bond with New York City from all these people that I know. And then you meet everybody in person because, you know, there's, you know, some will say video equals truth. To a certain extent, that is true because you're just kind of, I just open the camera and what you're seeing is what you're getting. You know, it's raw and it's... And, you know, it was funny because when we did Video Blog Week in 2004, it was like this big deal. We're going to do it for 7 days. Now people are posting videos every single day.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just out of control. And it's growing, and it's growing around the world. And people are doing things in politics and citizen journal. And other people are just talking smack, goofing off. Some people are making art play. I mean, so it's all over the board. You're going to maybe find something, you know, something that you like. And if you don't see something that you like, well, then why don't you do it yourself? Make the content that you like, because nobody is that unique that their content is going to be so unique. You know, there's going to be, like, a bunch of people that are going to dig it.
Well, everybody's going to be attracted to the things that they like the most. And that's just, I mean, as generic and basic as that sound, it's true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just like you had said, you know, earlier, you're not going to tell me what kind of mouse to get, you know, or just like you wouldn't tell me what kind of shoes are going to fit best on my feet.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same way with content. And, you know, this kind of, I guess, easy digestion and dissemination of content is just, that's, I think, the allure more than the content itself.
And there's completely different types of content. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen the Blue Man Group in concert.
Ponzi has.
Yeah, aside from their music, it's a very entertaining show, and they don't talk. It is all about the facial expression. That just doesn't translate to any other medium, you know? And it just fascinates me that so many people will try and put these three forms of media, text, audio, and video, into different boxes, going, but that's not the way it works, you know? Your personal preference might say that you like reading the paper or reading a book over, you know, listening to the radio. Or maybe you watch TV and you hate to read. You know, you just do what's going to work for you. But
I should probably dig up some of those old videos I did. They were like, you know, like 30-second, 60-second clips because that's all the, you know, camera could handle at that point. I'll see if I can find some good ones.
Yeah, do it. Set up a feed and, you know.
God.
I mean, we'll probably be video blogging in real time. Since the tools have changed a lot, I mean, I did some video blogging of Will Wheaton's, you know, book reading last year.
Yeah.
Now, you know, there's going to be a few people with cameras. It's going to be uploaded, and it's automatically going to be subscribed, and people are going to be downloading it as I finished uploading it.
I mean,
I think, powerful to people that might not be able to make it.
Well, and it's part of what makes me not feel so bad about, you know, limiting the audience to, like, 300 people. Which we had to do because of the constraints of the room. And, you know, quite honestly, it's not scalable to be able to provide, you know, Wi-Fi and power strips and food and beverage to everybody who's coming. It was impossible to do. And while I'm sure certain people are going to get a value of, you know, watching the content in real time, it just doesn't. It's not as good as being there, you know, in person and talking to someone.
Always too.
Yeah. That's the one thing that I think, you know, I think Gnomedex is kind of bridging that gap. I mean, we're not afraid of opening up our doors and windows to everybody. I mean, I don't care who comes and records things, you know, in audio, video, or text, or whatever format.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't bother me, and quite honestly, you know, our sponsors know it too. And I tell them, I said, well, you know, here's what I plan on doing, and, you know, here's why it's going to benefit you, you know, no matter what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, 9 times out of 10, they're okay with it. They kind of understand this is a new way to go. But there are very few other conferences that have really embraced this. But the one thing that, you know, I don't think it's been too much of a hindrance for us. Is, you know, our registration is going just fine. People want to be there because that's as much a part of the experience as anything else.
Yeah, and then you figure if anybody complains about it and they're like, well, the screw this, well, then that makes room for one more person that's dying to go.
Exactly. So I'm finding it to be a good thing insofar as, you know, attendance is going well. We've got our sponsors, you know, moving forward. Community seems to be embracing it at a really good clip, and it's probably one of those things that we'll probably be setting up to do the next Gnome Dex and announcing something at this one. So hopefully if things go well, then we'll be able to do that. So we'll
can't
see.
Wait, dude.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
Awesome.
So, all right, well, go play your poo games.
Oh, I'm going to have fun playing with poo games. Had to end it on a dirty note.
Yeah, no problem.
All right.
All right, talk to you later.
See ya.
Bye.
The Chris Perillo Show is brought to you by Microsoft Windows Media. Download Windows Media Player 10 at Microsoft.com/Windows Media.